the health dollars in America. So how do we do it? What do we do? Well, first off, we should do something in our schools. You know, only 25% of our schools have mandatory physical education. That was the only course I ever got an A in. And I want to get children back. You know, 25 to 30% of our children are overweight or obese. And yet we don't require them to have physical education. Does that make any sense? Doesn't to me. First thing we should do is get into our children and inculcate into them the idea about good nutrition and good food. The second thing we need to do, we need to talk to our doctors. Do you know that young medical students coming out of medical school may have 3 or 4 hours on nutrition? And when you look at the cost of medical dollars, which I just got pointed out, $2.4 trillion, 75% is in chronic illnesses, and a lot of that is food and nutrition, and a doctor coming out of medical school only has 3 hours on food and nutrition, does that make any sense at all? Number three, I tell my corporate clients, you know, you got to use some kind of financial stimulus sometimes to encourage people to do the right thing. I said, go into your cafeteria. And in your cafeteria, put in 2 lines on the fruits and the vegetables and the juices. Either give it away or subsidize it and only charge a buck. Then the high fats and the carbs, put in the second line, charge $5 for a hamburger, $10 for a cheeseburger, and 20 cents per French fry. You know something? You change human nature. And you're able then to start making a difference. The fourth thing is we got to go into the medical establishment. You know, have you been to a hospital recently? What's the biggest seller in the hospital cafeteria? It's pizza in a hospital. And doctors and hospitals and medical institutions, health clinics have got to reach out. It's a tremendous opportunity for medical facilities, medical institutions to do a job of educating and teaching, just like Leslie Stahl is doing. It's education at the medical school, at the hospital, the grade school, and so on. And we also have to do policies in the Department of Agriculture and Department of Health and Human Services. We have to get more information out, especially to minorities. Diabetes, which is a direct correlation to eating and obesity, it's an epidemic with Native Americans, Latinos, and blacks. If you want to change health care, which I do, which John McCain does, you got to put the emphasis on prevention and wellness and education. And that's what the next administration is going to have to do. And I hope that John McCain, I know John McCain is very interested, and I know Barack Obama is. Because in the last session of the Congress, there were 3 things that both political parties talked about in health care. One was wellness and prevention. The second one was information technology. And the third one was fixing Medicare. And there is bipartisan support. Difference how they're going to fix Medicare, but at least bipartisan support. So on the answer to the question that Leslie just asked me, and I'm sorry I went on so long, but I wanted to get it out and set the stage, is that you have to get the government involved in education. You have to get the Department of Agriculture and Department of HHS. You have to make sure that medical schools are starting teaching about nutrition. You have to get our schools and hospitals and medical facilities. And it's not heavy-handed, but the more we do it, the better chance we have of educating America and doing the job necessary to turn around the big consumption of health care dollars and get Americans healthier than ever before.
I have a fast follow-up before I allow other people to ask you some questions. But I was intrigued with what you said about the corporations subsidizing fresh fruit and vegetables and charging more for the fatty foods, the fructose and the fries and all of that. Do you see, as a Republican and as someone representing the McCain campaign, that a Republican administration would advocate such a thing as government policy, subsidizing fresh fruits and vegetables, and putting a tax, the ugly word, find another word for it, a surcharge, what did Reagan used to say, a fee, on fatty foods, the foods we know are contributing to the problem?
Well, Leslie, you know me, I'm a conservative, fiscally conservative Republican, and taxes and increased fees, I've never considered a panacea. And I don't think so in the food consumption. I think what you have to do is you have to invite in the food companies and the restaurant association, which I did when I was secretary, and talk to them about putting on their menus and so on, and telling them how important it is. And I think you can accomplish the same thing through persuasion and through education. The second thing, when I was I'm on the board of directors at Centene, which is a health insurance company in St. Louis. And I told them as a board member that I wanted them to try my theory on the two lines. You go into the cafeteria in Centene and you will see two lines. We subsidize one and the other one we charge. We make a profit out of it. We charge some and then add. And you will see in the Centene food lines that we are seeing definitely a decrease of consumption of carbs and high fat. And
but
it's just...
You wouldn't mandate such a
thing. I would not mandate it.
You know, the persuasion argument...
Yes, go ahead.
Because I did a story on calorie counts when you put the calories on the menus. And there was all kinds of pressure on these restaurants to do that. None of them would. And not until, for instance, New York City and some places in California, not until a law was passed did it get done.
Yeah.
And they don't want to do it. They know that people won't buy as much when they see those calories up there.
But I think a better way is to have the insurance companies charge more. I would advocate very strongly that the corporations in America and businesses would put in good health policies and then negotiate with the insurance company and show quantitatively how their cost of reimbursement from the insurance company goes down when employees. We're doing that at a company that I'm the president of up in La Crosse, LHI. And we have an opportunity, and the insurance company charges more for smokers, and we're going to go into the same thing on food.
What, you charge more?
Premium.
Explain how that would go. I mean, how do you know what people eat?
Well, you ask people if they're a smoker, and they put down, and you can pretty much tell, you know, we charge an extra $25-$30 for their monthly premiums.
So
for
you
smokers.
Say if you drink
But then we'd go, Leslie, one step further in my business. We go and tell those individuals that are smokers that we set up smoking cessation classes, like we're doing in food and nutrition. And we go to those and we invite not only themselves, the individual, in, but their loved ones, their family, in to take the courses. And we pay for that. And we give them a reimbursement of all their money that they paid in, plus a bonus if they will take the course on smoking. We're doing that on food and nutrition. And I think that the company that I'm the president of in La Crosse, Wisconsin, is going to be a shining example of what other corporations can do in the future along this line. So what I'm trying to do is start a movement of good corporate behavior, because what is the number one asset any corporation has is their employees. And there have been many studies out, I think there's been some studies here, on productivity and absenteeism. And people that are not healthy are not as productive, and they are not as punctual, or their attendance is not as great as somebody that is healthier. It's proven. And so you can show to a corporation, and this is starting to permeate throughout America. And I really think once businesses get involved in doing this and rewarding good behavior, this is going to be the best way to transform healthcare and chronic illnesses and wellness and prevention in America. And corporations and insurance companies, and go to the insurance companies and say, if we put these policies in, it's going to inure to your benefit because you're going to pay out less in medical claims. Therefore, you should lower our premiums for our good behavior as a corporation. that's where I think the big bang on prevention and wellness is going to be in the next several years.
Questions? Because I have some more if you don't.
Well, what about the whole $1 for the good food, $5 for the bad food in schools with the investment that government's already making in school meals and in the commodity diversions that happen there? There's a lot of infrastructure already in place to be able to affect some of what's being served in schools.
I don't know if you can charge extra for good foods in a school setting. You can do it in a business setting, and rightly so. I think in a school setting, I think you just got to go to the school boards and to the administration and serve better foods. I mean, there's nothing wrong with serving good, healthy foods in your lunch counters.
Except for it costs more.
What?
Except for it costs more.
It's much more expensive.
It's much more expensive, but the return pays for it. All you have to look at is 25 to 30% of your children in your high school and grade school that are fat and obese. It's money well spent. It is money as well spent as anything else in the classroom.
Would a McCain administration subsidize, add money to the school lunch program
I would be for that, Leslie. I don't know if John McCain would be, and you know the budgets are tough, but
yeah.
We got to get a handle on this obesity. And what's wrong with subsidizing? You know, we give out food stamps. You know, let's give out food stamps. You know, not to buy tobacco, but let's give food stamps out for more people to buy good foods. And we got a lot of surplus. Let's get that surpluses out. And let's subsidize in good nutrition. But you gotta start at the grade school, but it goes all the way up to medical schools.
What about government banning the selling of soda in schools?
Every time you ban it, it's just used more. I've never seen
forbidden fruit kind of thing.
Yeah, it's just.
But in the school itself.
It's starting that way, and I think you should encourage. I just don't think a federal law mandating it is the way to go. But I would put as much pressure as I possibly could as a citizen of that school to ban it. And I would also put a lot of pressure on Coca-Cola and Pepsi, you know, to, if they're going to have soda pop in their school, they have to at least have a 3-to-1 or a 4-to-1 or whatever it is, fruit juices and good nutritional food in their vending machines. That's the way I think you can get at it. You ban something, kids are smart. Every time you ban something, somehow the money goes up, it costs more, they just go down the block somehow and somebody smuggles it in and uses it. I think you got to educate and teach people and the value of fruit juices and whole grain breads and these kind of things that are going to have an impact on children. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
One of the things that I found in the course of losing weight, more than anything, was trying to get in appropriate nutrition.
Yes.
From foods. And when you get to looking at some of the fruits and vegetables, the fruit juices and such, if you're trying to keep your sugar levels down, eating a lot of fruit is the worst thing that you can do as far as your metabolism is concerned. So as you're trying to count calories, keep sugar levels down, getting good fruits and vegetables without messing up your metabolism can be an issue. I really think better education, not just with us lay people, but also our physicians would help in understanding and helping us to know more of what happens when one puts food in their mouth and how our bodies will react to it.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I couldn't have said it as well. I mean, doctors are wonderful people, but they know so little about nutrition and food. And we should have a mandatory course in every medical school in America to do that, and we should do a lot of that nutrition. I talk to my business clients. I encourage them to bring a nutritionist on and talk to the people and employees and really put on courses. We do that in some of my businesses. I also started, I was obese, but I'm chunky. I come from Wisconsin, where every meal is better with beer, brats, cheese, and cream. And it's usually lots of brats and lots of beer. But I started the Tommy Thompson diet, and you don't have to pay for it. You've heard of all the Mediterranean diet and all the other South Beach diets and so on. The Tommy Thompson diet. You know that when you were growing up, your mother and father and your grandpa and grandmother always told you, you got to clean your plate? You know, it made you feel guilty if you didn't eat everything on your plate. And that's the way, anyway, that's the way I was brought up. So I decided that there are no food police in this country. You know, there's no legislature, no Congress that has passed a law saying you got to eat everything on your plate. So I tell people, use the Tommy Thompson diet. Take whatever you want on your plate, but only eat 50%.
What about teaching this in school?
50%, and I lost 15 pounds on my diet. I know it hasn't improved my looks at all, but I am healthier and better. Just try it. For the next 3 weeks, take whatever you want, but only eat 50%. And nobody's going to arrest you. There are no food police. You'll feel better and you'll lose weight.
What about not just medical schools? What about teaching it in school?
Why not?
Yeah, why not?
Why not teach nutrition in grade school and in middle school and high school? What can be better? Your body is the most important thing you have. And one of the biggest, you know, they're cutting me off.
No, please finish. I got to cue. This is the...
There's some questions.
You wrap up. And then you wrap up.
No,
can you sum up?
One final question, this lady.
Final question.
Better and be more physically active.
Yeah. Good
what
for
I
you.
What I consistently hear from schools is that they have few resources, so that therefore they need to cut PE. And yeah. One of the reasons that they need to bring junk food into the schools is to make up for income, so that they can subsidize everything from paper and pencils to bus trips for kids. So it would seem to me that an administration that puts more income into education, that allows schools to open up PE again and to not need to subsidize, would have a tremendous impact on childhood obesity as well as on the health and wellness of our kids.
I disagree with you, because I was governor, and every time I put more money into the school budgets, it didn't get to physical education, nutrition. I like to have it more specific. I like what Leslie says. Let's subsidize. You know, I'm all for that. Foods into the schools, and let's teach nutrition. Let's start changing the educational establishment. And I think the federal government, the state government, should teach and subsidize a course on nutrition in every school in America. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.
Thank
and
you.
Let me finish with the Irish prayer. May the road always rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your forehead. And may the rain fall softly upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Thank you very much. I love you both.
Governor Thompson, you were fantastic. Thank you so, so, so much. Thank you. Now, is Senator Clegg next? Yes? Morgan, yes. Okay. Our next panelist is Senator Bob Clegg from New Hampshire. He did something extraordinary in the state of New Hampshire. He's a Republican. He got a law passed to force insurance companies to help pay for bariatric surgery. So I'm going to introduce Senator Clegg and ask him to tell the story, first of all, of his own bariatric surgery, and then about the law that he got passed in the state.
Thank you very much for having me come out tonight. I have to tell you that sitting here, I've learned an awful lot, and I also want to argue with a lot of people. So let me start with what happened to me. Thank you.
Yep. Usually they tell me I don't need a microphone. I've been a legislator for 14 years. So for me, my battle became very personal. I always carried this with me because I like people to understand exactly what it was that I was going through. When we talk about obesity-related diseases, let me read you some doctor's notes. The notes on my file said that I was an older gentleman. I can argue with that. With a long-standing history of morbid obesity, referred for bariatric surgery. I had a number of comorbid conditions, including severe gastroesophageal reflux. Now, that ended up being Barrett's esophagus, ended up being severe dysplasia, and more than once, the biopsies would come out to be low-grade cancer. So, and it was totally because of my obesity. I had a Nissen fundoplication. That's where they wrapped the stomach around the esophagus to attempt to stop the reflux from happening. And I can tell you that from a cost perspective, it's $1,500 every time I went in for an endo. And I would go in every 3 to 4 months because when they find anything that's close to cancer, they want to keep an eye on it because the cost of cancer is very expensive. And when you take a look at all the cancers, right now we know that 30 to 35% of the cancers that are going to be reported are going to be based on an obesity-related factor. Some breast cancers, some colorectal cancers are all related to the obesity factor. So what is it actually costing us? And when we think that we don't have the information, there was a test done in Canada where we actually found out that they compared 1,000 bariatric patients to obese patients who had had bariatric surgery to 1,000 who didn't, and 80% of those who had bariatric surgery didn't come down with the same obesity-related cancers. So we know that there's an awful lot of things that we can actually do. In my case, I was a BMI of 51, which was the first time I didn't like them using the word super when they referred to me. I was super obese. I just thought I was Superman. I'm the guy that used to be in the gym. For 2 years, I had a personal trainer. 6 days a week, sometimes twice a day, I would be in that gym with my trainer. It didn't work. I had sleep apnea so bad that my CPAP machine no longer was going to work. I had a doctor said, tracheotomy is the only thing we can do, but don't worry, we do it a lot. That wasn't an answer for me. I actually had a friend who's a marathon runner who said, I will spend as much time as it takes. Now, this is a female who hates to get up early in the morning, who every morning would meet me in the gym at 6 o'clock, work out with me, eat breakfast, meet me at noontime, eat lunch, and then meet me after the day to eat my dinner to make sure that I was doing everything I was supposed to do. It didn't work. I was getting heavier. I was maxing out every machine in the gym. I was strong as an ox, and I was the size of one. My metabolic rate was nothing. So I went to a friend who sent me to a guy in Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston, Dr. Lotz, who said to me, I can fix you. Now, it's not easy to get bariatric surgery, as most of you know. You have to go through 6 months of clinical trials to make sure you can lose weight. You have to go through a psychological assessment. I passed everything, and I went in. I've lost almost 140 pounds today. Now, when we talk about cost savings, I don't go every 3 to 4 months anymore for my esophagus. I don't have the esophageal reflux. I don't have a tracheotomy. In fact, I like to wear loose shirts to show I didn't get it. I don't have the joint pain I used to have, osteoarthritis. They don't give me Percocets 100 at a time now to say, take these. And believe me, being a legislator, I wouldn't take them. I would wait until Saturday night, knowing Sunday morning's my day, and I would take one Saturday night so I could get some sleep. That's how bad my pain was. So I was a huge burden to the system. It doesn't show up because I would go to my doctor once every 10 days and pay my $10 copay. Just look like anybody going in. Nothing says on the medical record that goes back to the insurer, obesity-related, 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 because they don't know. But it was. The nice thing about my doc, he's a friend too, my primary care physician, he now calls me every once in a while. I had forgotten that we used to see each other about every 10 days. After the surgery, he called me up. He said, hey, you still alive? I hadn't been there. I didn't have any problems. I don't have any problems today. Today, the pills I take, I used to take about 10 pills a day. I take a vitamin. And by the way, it's chewable. I count it as a meal. No, I'm not kidding. My biggest problem today is making sure I eat enough. I eat enough protein. So what happened to me? My insurance company had snuck in a provision that said, we no longer cover obesity-related diseases or treatments. We don't cover ailments. So when I looked at that, I said, okay, I'm fortunate enough I could pay for my bariatric surgery. But I took a good look at what was happening, and I said, whoa, wait a minute. Diabetes is obesity-related. Heart attacks, kidney, cancers, I've already mentioned. Some arthritis can be directly linked. So all of a sudden, the insurance companies in the state of New Hampshire are saying, we're not going to cover any of that. So as a state senator, and I used to be the majority leader, I went to them and said, who exactly do you think is going to pay for that? And they said, Medicaid. Well, geez, last I knew, Medicaid was my tax dollars from the state level and from the federal level, but it's still my tax dollars. So they were going to dump all of the big problems that society is facing because we are an aging population and we are an aging obese population. They were going to dump it on the taxpayer. I didn't like it. So I took my story to the legislature. And I said, not only is it not correct, but it's socially immoral to suddenly decide that anybody who had a disease related to obesity was no longer going to be covered by insurance. We regulate everything in this country. We regulate how you build a house, how they build cars. But for some reason, when we look at health care, we say, oops, can't have a mandate there. It's going to raise costs. Well, guess what? It raises costs when you allow insurance companies to say no to sick people. Obesity is a disease. We clearly know that it is a disease. I have a friend in the legislature, two tours in Vietnam. He's about 5 foot five, and he weighs about 325 pounds today. He's a diabetic. His diabetes costs $15,000 a year to treat. Bariatric surgery would cost $20,000. Insurance company says we're not paying for it. Everyone knows that if you have diabetes, chances are you're going to either have a heart attack or a stroke. He got lucky and had the heart attack. The heart attack costs $37,000. So when you think the $37,000 and the $15,000, already we've spent more money than we would have had we given him the bariatric surgery. He's now a burden on the system. By the way, he just had another heart attack. His doctors say, if we can cure your diabetes, we can make sure you don't have any more problems. Insurance company says it's not worth our while. I put that bill in. I fought it through the House and the Senate. In fact, in the Senate, we had 24 members in the Senate in the state of New Hampshire. We had a 23-to-1 vote. In the House, the insurance companies came out and they fought. And they said that it would raise everybody's rates tremendously. Of course, they didn't explain to us that in the last 4 years, this one particular company had an increase of 348% in their profit margin. So they're telling me we're going to raise the rates by 3%. And yet they've just had a 348% increase. And, oh, by the way, that increase in their profits was when they still did cover bariatric surgery. So we fought them. We fought them in the House of Representatives where the committee that oversaw this piece of legislation said, we don't think it's time. We think maybe we should wait and let's study it over the summer. In the state of New Hampshire, you study something over the summer, especially in election year, that's the end of it. So we fought them on the floor. Now, one insurer's doctor had an excuse and said, bariatric surgery is an unknown. We haven't done it long enough to actually know what the long-term effects are. And I'm a wise guy, and I said, thank God you weren't in charge of the polio vaccine because we'd still have iron lungs today with that kind of an attitude. And that's exactly the attitude that the rest of my committee decided to take. We were going to go fight this because if you say no to the treatments you know work today, then people suffer for an awful long time. When is there enough evidence? So we took the bill to the floor of the House. I'm not allowed to speak on the House. The committee report was don't let it go. Along came that gentleman I just told you about, and he stood up there and he said, we need to fix this. This can't go to summer study. We have to have it. I'm a perfect example. Unbeknownst to us, along came someone else. And she stood up and said, I had bariatric surgery too, but until Senator Clay came out, I was embarrassed to admit it. said, my medications used to be $70,000 a month. She says, I'm now only costing the system $20,000. Bariatric surgery actually saved that much money. Didn't cure her entirely, but it brought the cost to the system drastically down to where she actually made a difference. So on the House floor, they overturned the committee report. That's next to impossible. Now, for those of you who are here for politics, I'm a Republican. The majority in the House and the Senate in New Hampshire this term was Democrat. So it's not about whether you're a Republican or Democrat who thinks we should have mandates. It's about people and their real stories. And the next thing we know, somebody else got up, and they talked about it. So immediately the committee chairwoman came up and made a motion on the floor, let's kill this bill. And they lost again. And along came that little guy. He stood up and he said, ought to pass. And we won on a roll call vote. Everybody was willing to stand up, not only overturn the committee, but leadership positions were lost because the Speaker of the House did not want that bill to go through. But people knew it was the right thing to do. Now, it went to the governor. In our state, once it hits the governor's desk, he can either sign it, veto it, or let it go into law without his signature. Now, the fun part of this is our governor, his wife is a doctor. So she understood fully that we needed insurance companies to continue to be responsible members of the business community. So every time I saw her, she would say, Senator, you look great. What can I do for you? I'd say, get him to sign the bill. She would hit him in the arm and say, will you just sign his bill? And he would look at me and said, thanks a lot. Well, he didn't sign the bill. He let it go without his signature. We had long, long, long discussions, and he said, I just can't be responsible for an increase in the insurance premium to businesses. So what happened is, 2 weeks later I saw him, and what he said to me was, had I known today, then, what I know today, I would have signed that bill. And what he found out was the insurance companies came to him and said, we played the game, you won, but the reality is there is no bariatric case that doesn't have a payback within 20 months. So we did the right thing in the state of New Hampshire, and we're looking to help anybody else who wants to do the right thing. And I know Mike Huckabee, my good friend, is on a tight schedule, so I'm going to shut up now and move on. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you a yes and no, fasty. What you did, should it be national policy? Should the federal government try to pass such a law?
I absolutely think that the federal government ought to say that there are certain things we ought to cover, including obesity-related diseases and obesity as a disease itself.
Thank you so much. Thank you. By the way, you look great. How much did you weigh?
I weighed 380 pounds when I started.
Well, he said he didn't fit in an airline seat. So is Governor Huckabee here? Oh, there you are. Come on up. Come on up, everybody. Governor Huckabee of Arkansas, Mr. Slim. We all know, candidate for president. So
how
nice
are you?
To meet
good to see you.
I'm
Leslie.
Great. It's great to see
here.
You. Look at you. Well, you didn't have bariatric surgery, but you lost almost the same amount of weight.
110 pounds total.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what we'd like to know from you, because this is really a policy discussion, mm-hmm. is what do you think the federal government should do about this obesity epidemic? Do you think that it's right for government to get involved, to have regulation, taxation policy? Tell us what you think.
Okay. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to say what a beautiful facility this is. Just delightful. I got to hear a little bit of Tommy Thompson, and then, of course, my friend Bob Clegg, who I just came to truly adore as a wonderful friend in New Hampshire, and watched this amazing process that he's been through. And so he and I have both had a similar experience of dealing with some severe health problems and then finding them totally turned around by taking charge of our health. Now, we approach the issue of obesity a little differently in terms of the procedure. I did a process where I went to an endocrinologist at our local medical school and went through a long process of basically learning how to eat right and starting exercise and building upon that. I never had been an exerciser and eventually got to the place where I've now completed 4 marathons and am an avid runner. something I never thought I would do because I thought that was crazy to run. That's why God gave us cars. It seems logical to me. But the one thing that is evident, obviously we have a serious obesity problem. And by way of introduction, I want to get to Leslie's question, but I want to frame it a little bit. There are people who still deny that this is an issue. And when I hear that, I want to say, you got to be kidding me. Tell me that you really don't see this as a national epidemic. It is. And when people doubt it, I always give them this test. And I've never had anyone who did this little simple exercise that didn't come back and say you were right. Here it is. Go back through your files or closets or attic or wherever you keep old photos of you and your classmates when you were in the third grade. And pull out a photo, that class photo that everybody had made, you know, when you were in elementary school. Third grade picture of you and your classmates, the 20, 30 of you that were all there photographed together. Take a look at that picture. Just look at it. And the next day, go to any school in America. I don't care if it's public or private. I don't care what part of the country it is in. Go to that school and walk into a third grade classroom and just put your head in the door and look at that class. And tell me if you notice anything different about just the appearance of the class from your third grade picture. And I promise you, if you do that, you will never again question whether or not we have a severe obesity epidemic in this country, because that will settle it. What has happened, obesity has happened to us over an incremental time frame. And the result is that we've sort of been like the frog in the kettle. We have been boiled slowly and didn't realize it. But when you compare us, it is stark. March of 2005, there was a ferry boat that sank off the coast of Baltimore. Nobody could figure out why. It had been recently tested for seaworthiness and had been found in good shape. Everything seemed to be in working order. Nobody could figure out exactly why this boat had gone down. And they continued to try to figure it out, and you know, it was within its passenger limits, according to the Coast Guard standards. Then someone had the, maybe good sense to just do a little research. And here's what they found out. That the Coast Guard craft limits were based on the average adult American in 1962. When the average adult American weighed approximately 142 pounds. By 2005, the average adult American weighed 183 pounds, which is substantially different when you add quite a few people. And the truth was, while the Coast Guard standards hadn't been updated, people's bodies were significantly larger, and by weight, the boat was grossly overweighted, even though by number of passengers it has not been. Architects now have to go back in and redesign the egress patterns of buildings because people are in such poor shape they can't get out of a building in the same amount of time that it originally was designed to be done. So it is a huge problem. I faced it personally. I face it as a governor of my state. As a southern state, we are one of those that have a huge problem of not just obesity in adults, but childhood obesity, which is the most frightening of all. Because what we're seeing is type 2 diabetes showing up in kids as young as 7 and 8 years old. Didn't exist 15 years ago. That was a diagnosis that you couldn't find on a pediatric hospital floor 15, 20 years ago. You had type 1 diabetes, you had type 2. Type 1 was called juvenile, type 2 called adult onset, because it was all based on the chronology of a person's life. Only kids got type 1, only adults got type 2. Real simple. That age started dropping. And now kids as young as 7 and 8 years old, preteens, getting type 2 diabetes as a result in many cases of obesity and the genetic factor that's being passed down. We don't fully understand how much impact this is going to have genetically as generations now will have children. But estimates are that in another generation, kids as young as 16, 17 will drop dead at their school desk in high school from heart attacks, the result of this health crisis that we're in. And the real frightening thing is a child diagnosed with type 2 diabetes as a preteen will have serious vision problems in his 20s, will have a heart attack before he's 30. He will be in full, complete renal failure by the time he's 40 and on kidney dialysis. He will never see a 50th birthday. The startling fact, for the first time in American history in 232 years since 1776, a child born in America today is going to live a shorter life expectancy than his parents or grandparents. That has never happened in the history of America. This is the first generation of young Americans being born for whom that is true. It is a crisis. It's real. And we've got to address it. And the question is, so how do we do it? Do we start telling people what size cheeseburger they can have? Probably won't work. Because Americans love one thing even more than they love their capacity to go to the all-you-can-eat buffet. They love their personal liberties and freedoms, and they don't want anyone telling them what to do. What I like to do is to say that as a governor, when we focused on how to make this change, we recognize it's a cultural shift. It's not a programmatic shift. It's cultural. And secondly, it's not going to happen over an election cycle. And let me tell you the dirty little secret of politics. The reason that most people in politics don't take on something like this is because those of us in politics like to take on challenges of things that can be accomplished within an election cycle so we can run for re-election on it. Just a simple, hard fact. This requires some political leadership outside the normal paradigm of politics because you're going to plant seeds that will not necessarily bear their most important fruit in your cycle, even in your career. We're talking about some things that are policy changes and literally cultural changes that will be a generation away from fully coming into fruition. And that's why it is just not an urgent thing. In the course of dealing with this issue, one of the questions I had for insurance companies, and Bob, I found your presentation very interesting, because I sat down with CEOs of major insurance companies and says, why don't you guys cover things like preventive health, weight loss, bariatric surgery? The answer was interesting, surprisingly simple. Because the model of health insurance in this country is still a post-World War II employer-based medical insurance model, which means that people get their insurance largely from their employers. Now, in the post-World War II era, that made sense because you went to work for the factory, you worked there for 40 years, you got your gold watch, you were insured by the same company because you were employed by the same company. The average American changes entire careers every 7 years now. We are a very mobile society. We do not stay employed by the same employer. Let me just ask, how many of you here have been employed by more than one entity in the last 20 years? Maybe I should. How many of you have been employed only by one entity within the last 20 years? One, two, three, four. Okay. So, Leslie?
Five.
Well, Leslie, you're one of the rare exceptions. But, I mean, as you can see, obviously CBS is a good gig. Maybe we should all get on board with CBS. I'll give you my resume later if you want. My point here is that we are a microcosm of the country. If we did the same study nationally, we'd find that that's the truth. Now, here's the problem. You talk to an insurance executive, here's what he will tell you, if he will break down and be honest with you. And in a private moment, he will. He just doesn't want to be quoted on the record. An insurance company knows that the real cost savings for preventive health care, and particularly dealing with things like obesity and bariatric surgery, are not in the first or second or third year. There are some immediate savings, as Bob pointed out, as I could point out in my own personal experience, of the medications I don't have to take, of the doctor visits I don't have to have, of the fact that I'm in incredibly good health compared to what I was, even though I'm older than what I was. But here's what they'll tell you. They know that the real savings are in the outlier years. And they also know that there's a good likelihood that you're going to be insured by somebody else in those outlier years. They're frankly not interested in saving money for their competitor. If that insurance policy was going to still be yours in 5, 10, 15 years, they'd have a vested financial interest in trying to make sure that they did everything possible so that 10 and 15 years from now, you're not costing them the amount of money you're going to cost them because of obesity-related illnesses. So we have to change the model, and that's one thing that has to happen, or we're never going to fix this. And look, it's easy to bash the insurance companies. I'll join with the chorus of that on any given day. But the fact is, they're a business. They are in the business to make money and profits. And if they become unprofitable because they cover things that don't have a return, it's real simple. There will be no insurance except the government. And the government, quite frankly, cannot afford the growing cost of health care in this country because we don't have a health care crisis, we have a health crisis. The real issue is not that we have a health care crisis. It's not the lack of coverage. And if all we did was to provide universal coverage, we would just, frankly, accelerate the bankruptcy in which the country will eventually find itself if we don't change the basic model that we're dealing with, which is that we don't prevent disease, we treat disease after it's out of control and has become catastrophic. So The policies are important, but more than the policies, we have to step back and change the paradigm, change the philosophy, change the culture. And if we don't do that, then all of these programmatic things we do will not fix the problem, it will only exacerbate it, and economically it will crash us. So I would begin there by saying that there are larger issues than just saying, what are we going to make the doctors do, make the hospitals do, make the insurance companies do, make the government do? It's what are we going to do collectively as society to change our overall approach to what health means, and how do we get there?
So how does government affect that? Or does it? Are you saying government has to stand back, or
no,
government has to jump in?
Government has a role, but let me give you four examples of ways in which we have seen cultural shifts in my lifetime, and government had a role in all of them. And I'll try to be very, very brief with this as much as possible, but four cultural shifts. One was in the area of litter. A second one was in the use of seat belts. A third was in the realm of smoking, and a fourth is in the issue of drunk driving. Now, all of these are my own lifetime, so I can speak to them personally. I remember when people, even well-educated, sophisticated people, threw a bag of trash out the car window because that's just what people did. And you remember in the 60s when Lady Bird Johnson came along and told us that that really wasn't very acceptable and we needed to beautify America? So we started the Keep America Beautiful campaign. And the Indian cried and we all said, gee, we've got to do better. And so that was one of the first cultural shifts that we saw. Now, most state laws, including mine, our states, have laws that say that if you throw a cigarette butt out the window, that's litter. And we can fine you up to $1,000 for a single cigarette butt. You could never have advocated doing that in 1962 or 3 or 4. Second, smoking. All right, second, let me use seatbelts. Mm-hmm. You remember when seatbelts were an aftermarket device in the car? Nobody had seatbelts. Nobody. And if you wanted a seatbelt, you had to go to the local mechanic and ask him to put it in. And in my part of the world, if you went down south and said to a mechanic, I'd like for you to install seatbelts, he'd have looked at you and said, you want to do what? You want to put a strap in your car to hold yourself in? Have you lost your mind? Ralph Nader told us we needed to be wearing seatbelts. He wasn't very convincing, but Congress eventually put them in. They forced us to have them. They just didn't force us to wear them. The crash dummies came along, and they showed us what happens when we don't have them. And now every state but Bob Clegg's, New Hampshire, has a primary seatbelt law that says the police can stop you for not wearing a seatbelt. They don't have to have another reason. By the way, New Hampshire's motto is live free or die. So there you go. Smoking. Generation ago, if we'd have had this meeting in 1978, think about this. In 1978, if this meeting had been held in this library, there would have been ashtrays and half of this room, if the library would have allowed it, and probably would have in 1978, half of this room on a health conference would have lit up cigarettes and puffed away as some of us would have died a miserable death because of the smoke. And if we had said, excuse me, could you put that out, we would have been considered the people extraordinarily rude for asking that, not the people who were blowing smoke in our faces. Now, most states are smoke-free. I remember one of the proudest moments I had as a governor was signing a statewide Clean Air Act that banned smoking in every business in the entire state, not just restaurants and bars, every business. And people said that couldn't be done in a southern state like Arkansas, but it was, because the culture has shifted. Drunk driving. Remember when Foster Brooks and Dean Martin told us that it was just so funny to be driving drunk, falling down drunk? Mothers Against Drunk Driving came along and said it's not very funny. And now nobody makes fun of people driving drunk. Now, final thing. There were three major things that happened in each of those cultural shifts. Here they were. First, awareness. We changed the way we thought about it by education and advertising and awareness. The second thing was the atmosphere. We changed how we approached them. We put litter baskets out and no litter signs. We changed the way we were confronted in the atmosphere. And the third thing was action. Once the culture shifted, government then codified into law what had become the new behavioral norm. Now, if government tries to codify into law a behavior that is not a new norm, what you'll find is outright resistance, if not utter rebellion. So the government's role is not to first pass the law and then try to change people into liking it. It's to change people's minds, attitudes, and mindsets so that then the law can be changed without an absolute revolution taking place over it. Try a no-smoking law 15 years ago, or in fact 10 years ago, 5 years ago in my state, and I'd have gone up in smoke. But I found that there was a point at which the tipping point had happened, and then we could pass that law. So the question is, how do we get there? What we do is we do it like we've always dealt with cultural changes. We're going to have to engage in an extraordinary level of education, awareness, advertising, and a complete rethinking of this issue. Then we're going to have to change the atmosphere. President Clinton and I worked together in a bipartisan way during my last year as governor and as chairman of the National Governors Association in the partnership with the American Heart Association, removing all soft drinks, all sugared soft drinks out of every school in America with a voluntary cooperation of PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, and Cadbury Schweppes. It was a historic agreement. I cannot begin to tell you how delicate the negotiations for that became. Because of this was a big movement. I know it's easy to bash the soft drink companies, but to their credit, they came to the table and they voluntarily pulled every sugary soft drink out of every school in this country and replaced them with fruit juices, waters, and sports drinks and other things. You can argue, well, they didn't go far enough, but they went a lot further than they had to go. Nobody forced them, but they saw the handwriting on the wall. My point is that there are ways that we can start getting there.
That was really smart. What you just said. Really smart. That whole thing. Now I want to do a 60-minute story, and you're going to help me figure out how to do something.
Usually that's dangerous. When 60 Minutes shows up on your doorstep,
I know.
It's not good.
But think about the reach. Think about the other side of it.
Yeah.
We have to think of something. Because
I see
think
Mike
the
Wallace
education...
chasing me down the alley, I'm out of here, okay? I'm telling you.
Yeah, but I've got high heels on. I can't run as fast as you. All right, I think that you really set the table, and I think you have an incredibly well-educated group of people here who I know want to ask you some questions. So let's open it right up, because the table has been set beautifully. Woman back there.
And the table has been set, but it's not an all-you-can-eat buffet, by the way. So.
Thank you, Governor. I'm from the great state of Pennsylvania as a delegate, and I would love to hear at the convention this sort of statement about the McCain policies. When you were speaking, the first thing I thought of was John F. Kennedy's movement to have the children be healthy. Remember, we were trying to forget exactly how he was approaching it, but that was the earliest time. And then, of course, the crying Indian. I think that's an excellent idea that the presidency can be used as the bully pulpit for healthy change. And thank you very much.
I totally agree with you, but let me tell you, I had a section in the speech that I'm to give, and I'm not sure when I'm going to give it. It was supposed to be tonight. Now it was Thursday, then it's now Wednesday. I don't know. I may not be speaking at all. But the section on that was excised out because I only had 1,252 words, and so the speech gurus, you know, said, why don't you take this out? Let's put, you know, keep this in. And so I started out with a speech twice as long as what I'm going to end up being able to give. My point being is that I wish I could get some attention for this. I tried on the campaign trail. I desperately tried. As a candidate, I focused on this. I put it in every speech. I went out there. And you know what? In the first 9 debates we had, you know how many health care questions we had for Republicans? In the first 9 debates, one. Tommy Thompson got the question. I was over there begging, please, give me a shot at this. This is something I understand, something I've been dealing with. One question. By the way, you know how many questions on education in the first 9 debates? Zero. Now, every kitchen table, people sit around talking about health, they talk about education, they talk about things that affect their families. We never got those questions. And so part of my problem, with all due respect, Leslie, some of the members of the Fourth Estate, who never asked us the substantive questions in the debates and brought those topics out. And we ended up saying the same things about Iraq and the same things about the same topics. And like about Iraq, there were 12 Republicans starting out. Only one differed from the rest of us, and we could have given him 2 minutes and let him riff away on what he thought about Iraq, and the rest of us could have just said ditto on our part and be done with it and then talk about these other issues.
I'm giving you a great opportunity. We're going to do a story together.
Good.
Okay.
I'm so glad you are.
Let me ask you one issue. What?
If I could just interject a point here, because it's relevant to what you just said, but the Republican Party platform, which I'm not sure the convention has finished adopting yet or not, but it does for the first time, and the Democrats did it last week in Denver. This is the first time that either, now both national parties have even recognized obesity in their party platform. And the RNC platform does call for a national campaign on obesity, grassroots campaign particularly targeted at children. So we applaud the effort. We know it's hard to break through, but we are making a lot of progress on that. I know someone who's been involved in platform activities in the past, you recognize that's a significant step.
Along those lines, and particularly bouncing off what you've talked about, public awareness, you know, across the country, I'm now told, kids in school are spending less and less and less time in gym. The gym has been cut back to put in other activities. How do you reverse that? That's astonishing, because the obesity problem has been with us now for at least, I mean, in public awareness, at least 5 years. And over those 5 years, gym keeps going down.
But just traditional gym classes are probably not going to be very helpful, because traditional gym classes still end up becoming a showcase of competitive sports where a few kids play and the rest sit on the sidelines and watch.
Good point.
Dodgeball. Look, when I was in junior high, you know what I learned to do? I knew when we played dodgeball, which is about all our gym class was, it was some disgruntled football coach who was forced to deal with us in P.E., and we'd play dodgeball. I learned very quickly that if I would run out there and stand and get hit by their first ball, I could go sit up and read and be prepared for the test. And there were only a handful of kids that were really interested in sweating that hard in second period and stinking the rest of the day. And so you had a few kids that didn't need the exercise who were getting it, and those of us who did who weren't. Traditional gym classes are not the answer. What we need is to develop activity. Now, there's a wonderful program that Dr. Kenneth Cooper, the founder of Aerobics, has developed for schools. It's called FitnessGram. And it's a online, computer-based, really individualized program where a student develops an activity program. And it's not so much about competitive sports in a gym environment as it is developing an activity program that fits that particular student's profile and then helps that student to follow the profile. I would urge you to go to Dr. Cooper's website, get some information. If you're really interested in what I think is working, and I've seen this work in some schools in Iowa where I went and visited with Governor Vilsack when we were both governors. I've seen it in Texas. They're pushing it across the state. Other schools are doing innovative things that are simple. For example, halfway through a math class, asking all the students to stand by their desk and to do some jumping jacks in the middle of the class. They find that that stimulates their brain activity a little bit because they get sluggish sitting there. Parking the buses 3 blocks from the school and having the kids walk the rest of the way on a nice day. It's not gym class, but it's activity. So the key is activity, getting kids moving and active. And that's the real the focus and the goal.
Question? Back there? Yes, you.
Is it likely that dietitians get covered under insurance or in schools, especially in pediatric clinics?
Well, it's not just dietitians that need to be covered. You know, I argued for a long time that it doesn't make much sense that we pay $35,000 for a foot amputation, but we wouldn't pay the, you know, $100 for a visit to the podiatrist. That didn't make much sense. You know, we don't cover a $150 visit to a dietitian, but we'll cover $100,000 for a quadruple bypass. There are a lot of things that ought to be. I mean, I think there ought to be either tax credits, tax deductibility for such things as legitimate gym memberships. Give some type of incentives. In other words, when you give people incentives, it works. We did for our state employees a number of incentives, up to $500 off on their health insurance if they didn't smoke, did a health risk assessment. They took us up on that. First year, 18,000. The second year, over 30,000 did that. Then we started giving points to employees for the number of steps they walked, the number of pounds they lost. They could get points that would be rewarded with time off. You know, it occurred to me that we give people sick leave. In other words, we reward them for being sick, but what do we give them for being well? I'll tell you, we give them the extra work of their colleagues who are sick all the time. It's what we give them. That doesn't make sense. So why don't we start building an incentives for people who are actually saving us money? So yes, we should cover the dietitian, we should cover the nutrition counselor, we should cover you know, the health coaches. We started doing that for diabetics in Arkansas, putting them with diabetes coaches. We established 23 different diabetes education centers. You don't have to have a medical doctor or an endocrinologist. It can be a pharmacist, it can be a nurse's aide, it can be a nurse, it can be a number of people in the healthcare profession. But people need some accountability, and they need some coaching on which foods trigger their glycemic index, which ones don't, when to eat those things, how many meals. And a lot of that, it takes time. The trouble is the current insurance system does not reimburse for treatment. It reimburses for procedures. And if a doctor spends more than 15 minutes with you, he's losing money. He's not covering his overhead. Issues like obesity and diabetes require more than a 15-minute doctor visit because it requires coaching. It requires information. That's time-consuming, but it's not reimbursable. So until we start creating a reimbursable system where we actually are achieving quality, then we don't have a healthcare system, because a healthcare system isn't a system without a quality component, which we don't have in the system today.
Gentleman in the back.